It has been said that the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And one of the things I love to do with my students is I take them on as many trips to the lands of the Bible as I can possibly do. And sometimes when we go to Luxor, cultural vertigo kind of sets in. We're standing there in the temple at Thebes, and you have a German guide over here speaking in Hochdeutsch, and you have a French guide over here speaking in French, you have an Arabic guide over here, and you have me, and they're standing there looking at these columns and images of pharaohs and Queen Nefertiti and hieroglyphics, and right about that point, they get cultural vertigo. They realize that this isn't like home. And not everybody speaks King James English here. In fact, very few people do. Yea, verily. And it reminds my students that sometimes disorientation is important on the way to reorientation to understand the text of the Bible. Here's my mantra for this afternoon, for this session. You can repeat after me. A text without a context is just a pretext for whatever you want it to mean. Let's see if we can do that together. A text without a context is just a pretext for whatever you want it to mean. Anachronism is a serious problem in interpreting the Bible, and anachronism is the reading into the text of modern notions, modern ideas, modern presuppositions, modern philosophical assumptions into the text. And one of the hedges against that kind of inflation is, in fact, looking at the social world and the social context in which the New Testament is given. Now, let me contrast that, which we're going to talk about, by giving you an example of the problem. When I was pastoring near Asheboro, North Carolina, one of my new Christians, Glenn Ray Smith, came to me one day and said, "Pastor, I have a problem." I said, "Okay, how can I help?" He said, I'm a carpenter, and I have this carpenter I'm working with, and he says it says somewhere in the scriptures that you can't breed dogs. And I said, "Glenn Ray, I don't think that's true, but just to be on the safe side, I will look through the lexicon and look into the dictionaries and just look at all the references to dog and see what I can come up with. Just be patient." So I got out my Thompson chain reference, King James only lexicon, and looked up every Peepikin reference to dog, and there was nothing in the New Testament of any relevance, but there was this text in the Pentateuch that read as follows, "Thou shalt not breed with the dogs." Now, I went back to Glenn Ray and I said, "I have some good news and I have some bad news." The good news is you can go right ahead breeding them hunting dogs. It's okay. No problem. The bad news is you can't have anything to do with foreign women. He says, "That's no problem. My wife's from Chatham County. It won't be a problem." A text without a context is just a pretext for whatever you want it to mean. So I want to talk to you about five of the social building blocks, if I can, from the first century world. Five major concepts. And the first of these will maybe be the most counterintuitive, so I want to deal with it first. It's what is called dyadic personality. Dyadic personality is the understanding that personality is chiefly formed by those whom you are related to, the social or kinship group that you are primarily a part of. Have you ever noticed that people in the New Testament don't seem to have last names? I mean, imagine the Galilean phone book. "All right, Vern, which Jesus is this? We got 97 Jesuses here. None of them have a last name. How can we tell?" You know, Jesus is Jesus of Nazareth. Okay. Saul is Saul of... Interesting. He's not Saul Tarsus any more than Jesus is Jesus Christ. Those are not last names. They're either geographical names or titles. People's identities were established, as it was thought in the first century world, by geography, gender, and generation, the three G's. Where you came from, what sex you were, and who you were related to determined who you are. Your identity was not determined by how you stood out from the crowd, but rather by what crowd you were inherently embedded in. Now, I realize that for modern radical Western individualists, not to mention modern radical Western Southern Baptist individualists, this may be counterintuitive. I am who I am. It's distinct. It's different. God made me special. Here I am. Well, survey says on further review, that's probably not the essence of who you are if you accept a first century notion of personality. A first century notion of personality, among other things, doesn't involve usually the concept that your personality develops over time. If you're asking, why do we have only one story in all the Gospels about Jesus as a boy? The answer is that people didn't believe in antiquity that your personality developed over time, so it didn't much matter what Jesus did as a boy or as a child. What mattered was that he came, and most ancient peoples believed you were born with a certain personality, and you were stuck with it, and that that personality was determined by geography, gender, and generation. That's what determined your personality. Personality would be revealed over time, not developed. And in addition to all of that, it was very fundamentally believed that how a person died revealed what God thought about you as a person. So you can imagine what crucifixion did in the mind of many ancient people when it came to Jesus. Remember what Nathanael said when he was invited to come see Jesus. Can anything good come out of Chitlin Switch? Was the rejoinder. The assumption was that if you were born in some obscure little one-stoplight town like Wilmore or Paytona or Wadi or Nazareth, then you couldn't possibly be anybody significant. Your geographical origins determined who you were. Surely Mashiach could not come out of Nazareth. Not possible. Then there was the issue of generation as well. Who your daddy was, especially daddy, mattered in a patriarchal culture. You know, we have Simon. You remember Simon? Jesus called him Cephas, which means rocky. And the way that this Simon, named after one of the Maccabees, was distinguished from other Simon is that we have this patronymic called Barjona, which means son of John. So his real name was Rocky Johnson. Simon, son of John. His identity is determined by whose child he is. Whose child he is. Now, it's telling that when you have in Mark 8 that discourse about between Jesus and his disciples at Caesarea Philippi, he asks them the 24,000 shekel question, who do people say that I am? And some say, well, you're one of the prophets, maybe even John the Baptist part Dieu, you know, come back from the dead. maybe you're like Jeremiah or Elijah. And then he points his finger at them and says, okay, and who do you say that I am? And the response is, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Do you notice that all of the titles of Jesus tell us who he is in relationship to somebody else? He is Son in relationship to God. He is Son in relationship to humankind. He is the Anointed One, the Christ, the Mashiach of God. He is Lord over us. His identity is established by who he's related to and how he relates to them. It's not established by that which distinguishes him from all other beings. It's established by who he's related to and how he's related to them. Now, growing up in the South, you know, you can kind of understand this. My mother is big on genealogy. You know, she's wanting to know who our second cousins twice removed for tracking dirt on the rug are. And I'm going, Mom, give it up. You know, why do we need to know? I guess I'm more of a modern individualist than she is, but she happens to think blood is thicker than baptismal water, and that the physical family matters more than the family of faith. And if you think that, then we all need to have a little talk, because Jesus thought the family of faith was the most important thing. But what I notice about this is that even in our culture, gender, genealogy, and geography seem to matter an awful lot in the way we evaluate who a person is. I've just been enjoying talking to Professor Drinkard, who is a fellow Tar Heel, and not only a fellow Tar Heel, he grew up 15 miles from where I grew up, so it was nice to hear a real North Carolina accent. And I was thinking about this as we were chatting and talking together. We were comparing notes on barbecue restaurants in North Carolina, and I was thinking, what a splendid fella he is. He has the same gender, the same geography, and a similar generation to mine. And it occurred to me, I thought, you know, that's not very different from the way ancients viewed human personality. Of course, those things affect who we are. But if we are Christians, then the chief thing we ought to be believing is, if anyone is in Christ, they are a whole new creation. The old has passed away. Not is passing away, not may pass away, but Paul says the old has passed away. We need to evaluate the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament in terms of personality theories that comport with what the assumptions were in the day about human personality. So, dyadic personality. Let's move on. The next port of call is reciprocity. The first century world was a reciprocity culture. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Very much like modern mafia culture. I will do you a favor in exchange for which you will do me a favor, after which I will do you another favor, after which you will do me a favor, or you will sleep with the fish. So said Don Corleone. Well, now that is, in fact, at the essence of ancient culture. Mafia culture is just a modern manifestation of Mediterranean culture. That's what it is. It's a you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours kind of culture. I'll do something which will set up a reciprocity cycle. And I would just say to you as a footnote that many churches operate on the basis of reciprocity rather than grace. If that hasn't dawned on you yet, just you wait, Henry Higgins, just you wait. It will occur to you that we don't really live in a grace-filled environment. We live in an environment where the culture says you don't get something for. It has been said that if we offered salvation for $5 a head, we'd have a line from Louisville to Lexington to get it. But because we give it away for free, people are suspicious of it in a reciprocity culture. You don't get something for nothing. Now, that ancient Reciprocity cycle could be a vicious cycle. It was a way of developing clients or clientele and bringing them into a social web from which they could not extricate themselves. It was a way in a pre-capitalist, pre-democratic society of establishing job security or financial security or economic security. Sucking up is what we might call it in the academic environment. It happened quite a lot. If you were to stand outside a Roman villa at dawn in Rome or some other city that was a Roman colony city, what you would notice is a long line of people waiting outside the door of the villa to see the master of the house, to make a business deal with him, to get your assignment for the day. If you were one of his clients, if you were one of his slaves, you were waiting for your sportula, your picnic basket before you go out in the fields. All of you were indebted to the company stove. All of you are indebted to the master, the patron, because reciprocity is a patron and client kind of thing. Now, we have patrons today. I was looking at the patronage picture of Mr. Norton when I walked in this seminary. He was a benefactor, as it says on the sign. That's a patron. Patrons and clients, the reciprocity cycle, are set up between those kind of people. But that's not all that's true about that society, because to understand patrons and clients and reciprocity, you need to understand that it's an honor and shame society. So the third thing that I would want to say to you is that it was an honor and shame society. And I will say to you that a society that loses its sense of shame also loses any clear notions of honor. And I think we are pretty much there in our culture. These are concepts that go together. What's an honor and shame society? Well, if you were to go to most Oriental cultures, you wouldn't have to ask that question. In an honor and shame society, honor is more important than your life. And shame is worse than death. This is the society Jesus lived in. This is the society that Paul lived in. To be dishonored, to be shamed, especially to be publicly shamed. And the chief or most extreme form of shaming in antiquity by Romans was crucifixion. This is how you publicly dissed somebody to make sure that their family was never heard from again or notable or noteworthy. In an honor and shame culture, you have this obligation to uphold the honor of your family and your kin group. And that kin group may be rather large. It may involve a tribe. It may involve a whole people. You notice that the Romans weren't called Italians. They were called Romans. And everybody wanted to be a citizen of, not Italy, Rome. There was this particular in group that was considered the most honorable status in the Roman Empire, being a Roman citizen. When Paul got in hot water in the temple in Jerusalem, and he's picked up by a Roman tribune or centurion, and he's just about to be flogged, he says, "Oh, by the way, I'm a Roman citizen." And suddenly the tribune's falling all over himself saying, "Excuse me." Honor and shame establish the way that kind of world works. It's still that way in the Middle East today. If you go to Jerusalem and you want to go to any of the shops in East Jerusalem and you want to buy something, let's say a small Persian rug or something for your house, you're going to haggle. But it's not like an American flea market, because you're going to have to bargain on the basis of honor. "I'll offer you 500 shekels for that imitation Persian carpet there." "Oh, sir, I could not possibly give it to you for 500 shekels. My mother hand-knit that carpet, hours at a time with her fingers bleeding. If I do not sell it at an honorable price, I will have dishonored my mother. And after a while, you realize that he's absolutely serious. You can't offer him a price that would shame him or his family. And so there's this cycle of negotiations until you get to what everybody is agreeable as an honorable price. We don't worry about that in American flea markets because this is not an honor and shame culture. It just isn't. If you don't understand the inner workings of an honor and shame culture, there are oh so many things about the Bible you're not going to get. You cannot assume that our culture is identical with that culture because it isn't in ever so many ways. During World War II, you remember the kamikaze pilots at Pearl Harbor and other places? These were young Japanese men who crashed their airplanes into the decks of our aircraft carriers and other items. And Americans were scratching their heads and saying, what is up with that? Why would they do that? I'll tell you why. Because honoring their forefathers and their native land was far more important, that they would honor those things than living. Far more important than living. Americans have a hard time understanding that. Life seems to be the most important thing. It's one of the reasons why in America we have a whole nother religion. It's called medicine and health care and hospitals. And the philosophy undergirding modern medicine is this life is all there is. You have to prop it up at all costs. The temples are the hospitals. The priests are the doctors and nurses. And the mantra is this life is all there is, so we must rescue it, save it, or heal it at all costs. It's not a Christian philosophy of medicine. We live in a very different culture than the Bible was a part of. Reciprocity, patronage, dyadic personality, honor and shame, and last but not least, limited good. Well, there may be one more if we've got time. Limited good. Now, this is another foreign notion to us. You know, when I go around and talk to children in public schools, I say, where does food come from? You know what the 99% answer is? From the grocery store. What happens when you run out? Oh, no problem. They'll make more. We'll go get it. That's all we got to do is show up. It'll be there in the morning. We live with the myth of unlimited resources in our culture, and it is a myth. My wife is a biologist. She teaches at Asbury College. She informs me that we have exactly, so far as we can tell, only 19 more years worth of fossil fuels in the earth, even if we mine them all. And that's at a present consumption rate. When it's gone, it's gone. It's not a replenishable resource. We don't live in a world of unlimited good, but thank goodness we live in a universe of unlimited grace, which is a very different matter. Limited good says, if you have it, I don't have it, and the only way for me to get it is to take it from you. Now, this makes perfect sense in a culture known for shortages. I've spent time teaching in Moscow and various places in Russia and Estonia. And they know all about bread lines and standing in line. And they know all about how it is when the person in front of them gets the last loaf of bread and there's not one for their family. And you will see tugs of war between the last two people as to who's going to get the loaf of bread. Because if they have it, I don't. And if they have it and I don't, my family doesn't eat. Limited good. Jesus lived in a world of limited good, which made it very, very counterintuitive when he told that parable of the workers in the vineyard who lined up to get paid at the end of the day. And the one that was hired only for an hour or two at the end of the day was paid first and was paid the same amount, a full day's wage. And the people who came after said, oh goody, we're going to get more. Now that would be counterintuitive in a culture of limited good, precisely because it wasn't based on the notion of grace. It was based on the notion that there's only so much that can go around. These concepts undergird our reading, should undergird the way we read the New Testament, because the New Testament is not written in late Western English for people like you and me. It's not written to people living in a democratic or capitalistic society. It's not written exclusively for Americans or Canadians or Mexicans. It's written to an audience 2,000 years ago who lived in a very different world than we do. And therefore, the end result of that is we must do our homework. I once had a student who came up to me and said, he was frustrated. I don't know why I need to do all this study in Greek and in Hebrew. I don't know why I need to do all this preparation to preach. I can just get up in the pulpit and the Spirit will give me utterance. I responded, it's a shame you're not giving the Holy Spirit more to work with. The truth of the matter is, friends, that the Word of God was expressed firstly in the words of human beings 2,000 years ago, and it is incumbent on us to apply the whole of ourself to the text and the whole of the text to ourself. And that means that we have to look at the historical milieu, the social milieu, the rhetorical milieu, the literary milieu. We could go on and on. There are lots of different important contexts if we're going to understand the content. For example, idioms are often what gets lost in translation. Let's consider the idiom, I have an axe to grind. Now, if I translate that directly into German, and talking to a friend of mine in Tübingen, he's going to go, okay, Ben, what tree are you planning on chopping down? Make sure it's not an endangered species. You see, the idioms from one culture are not the same as an idiom from another culture. They don't translate literally very well. And therefore, a literal translation may not be the most helpful one when you're dealing with such different cultural concepts. Now, that's going to be counterintuitive for some or much of your audience, but that is the truth. If the question is getting at the meaning of the text and trying to explain that or translate it into an equivalent meaning in our text, we must know both cultural contexts, their differences and their similarities, and look for points of analogy for translation, interpretation, and application. That's critical that we do so. One last thought. The first century world was a patriarchal world. It was, in that great philosopher James Brown's words, a man's, 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 man's world. It was very much a man's world. To some extent, but only to a limited extent, do we live in that world in modern America today. And it's not clear that it would be a good thing if we went back to all the aspects of that first century patriarchal culture either. In Genesis, it tells us that one of the effects of the fall was, the curse on the woman was, your desire will be for your husband and he will lord it over you. That's the fall, friends. It's the curse. To love and to cherish will become to desire and to dominate. To love and to cherish will become to desire and to dominate. Patriarchal culture, as we see it in the Bible and as we find it, is part of general fallen culture. And it needs to not simply be replicated in the modern world and baptized and called good. What we need to do is take the directives of Jesus and Paul and others and look at how they're setting about to put the yeast of the gospel into an already existing situation and change it. The social context of the gospel can help you read or even misread the text. It's my hope that you will give it your full attention and study it at length. Thank you very much.